Episode 1059, What the Facts?
Welcome to the Sci-Fi Christian, bringing you theology at warp speed. I'm Matt Edison.
I'm Ben DiBono. If you listen to the Rambo episode, the music is in fact working again.
We fix it. Man, that last episode was a mess, but there was some, I was just saying to Ben off the air, there are some hidden gems in that episode.
Yeah.
So even if you didn't, or if you have not watched Rambo 3, you should still listen to that Rambo 3 episode because we mostly don't talk about Rambo 3.
Yeah, you know, if a professional podcast place wanted to hire us and they said send in your top three episodes on a demo reel, I don't think we'd send that one.
No, that one did not go well. But here we are.
Wouldn't make the cut, but we liked it. We liked it.
And this episode, something you've been working on, I don't know what it's about.
So, yeah, this episode is going to talk about facts a little bit. Because
You're saying just facts, F-A-C-T-S?
Yes,
so just not the like facts, like a fax machine.
No. Okay. No, we're not going to cover faxing, but we're going to cover facts.
Okay.
So, in some of these reality bending, I don't know how to best classify them, this scene with the in episodes, simulation episodes, you know, we've circled around this idea of facts a couple times. I've made the case, like when we were talking about, you know, you getting your dog, that which I think was in the news episode, that, you know, you will feel like you are making this for a rational reason, but eventually you'll just make the decision that we like to think like we're being rational, but really we kind of supply reasons after the fact. So I brought this up, and conceptually I think it's fairly easy to understand, but it's a different thing when you experience it in real life. And I experienced this in kind of a profound way about a week and a half ago. Now, what I'm going to describe, I think that you probably will be able to recreate on your own. And that's part of what is exciting about this. Now, this isn't a lab experiment, so I can't promise that 100% of you are going to be able to recreate this experiment 100% of the time, especially since one aspect of this experiment is going to be your subjective judgment of certain things, which is the part of it that's most likely to fail. But nevertheless, I think that you are, you know, you'll be able to take what I did and what I describe in this story, and you could recreate this and prove to yourself whatever you think this proves. And we'll get there with some implications in just a second. So I'm going to start by sounding extraordinarily arrogant, and that walls will come crashing down on that in just a bit. So just hang on. I know a great deal about theology, and specifically Catholic theology, the study of, you know, the origins of Christianity, all of that. So I have two higher degrees in the subject. I've also done a lot of independent study on it. All that to say that around sort of that general topic of Catholic Christian theology, I think I know considerably more than the average person. In fact, I would estimate that I'm in the top 1%. Now, when you say you're in the top 1% of people on any given topic, that's actually less impressive than it sounds, because it means that there's potentially 80 million people who are better than you. You know, with 8 billion people on the planet, you could have a lot of people in front of you and still be in the top 1%. Nevertheless, I think if you were to randomly gather 100 people from anywhere, and I would be on average among the top one or two that would know the most out of that random gathering, should I be in the group, about Christian theology, questions of how the Bible came to be, all of that. Okay, so I know my stuff.
All you've got me wondering is, what am I in the 1% of? What am I in the top 1%
of? It's actually a really totally different topic.
Yeah.
But when you, the other flip side to that of 80 million people can be better than you. On the one hand, it should be like, okay, you're in the top 1%, but big deal. On the other hand, it's not that hard to get into the top 1%, especially if you said,
like something specific.
Yeah, yeah. So we should talk about talent stacking sometime, which is a Scott Adams-ism, and it's brilliant. But if you were to find three or four complementary areas in your life that you wanted to get into the top 5% of, that wouldn't be that hard, and that could make you exponentially more successful.
Another business advice from Ben episode?
Could be.
I'm interested in that.
Okay. So to go back to this then, that's the setup. I know my stuff. And I'd say I also know my facts. And as you can imagine, based on the title of this episode, we'll come back to that. Okay. So the specific scenario is I'm overhearing, or at least tangential to, a conversation. I'm not really participating in it, but I'm kind of listening to it. And it has to do with one of our favorite topics that we've talked about, the origins of the Bible, especially all of the extra books out there. Now, this was broader than what we've talked about of kind of the deuterocanonical books, where in our conversations, we sort of have the normal canon of scripture, the Protestant canon of scripture, we have the Catholic canon of scripture, and there's a debate about a small subset of books. When you get into the larger Gnostic gospels out there, that's a very different conversation. And I think that although Catholics, Protestants, Orthodox might disagree on some of the subset, we're all in agreement on the larger Gnostic gospels, Gnostic early writings, and all of that. And it's actually something that, again, I know a fair deal about. I wouldn't say that I'm necessarily the foremost expert or anywhere close to it, but I know a fair deal about this, and especially in the history of early Christianity. So as I'm listening to this, I hear somebody espousing the position of, well, the church suppressed all of those, and, you know, that the Bible that we have right now is a political tool and a means of manipulation. In other words, it's not, you know, all of those were just as valid as what wound up in the Bible and in the New Testament. They just lost out for political reasons. And as I was listening to this person espouse his opinion, it occurred to me that every fact he said, I mean, obviously there's the conclusions, there's the opinion, but everything he said was wrong. Like, everything he said was wrong in a small way or a large way. His facts were wrong. He clearly is not in the top 1% of this. Like, clearly. Okay. So, game, set, match, right? Like, I know my stuff. I have my opinion. He doesn't know his stuff. He has a different opinion. Clearly, I'm right, he's wrong. That's what the facts would lead us to believe. But there's a couple of twists to this. The first one is that there was somebody else in the conversation who was espousing a position, we'll say, in the ballpark of mine. Everything he said was wrong, too. Factually. Like, all the facts were wrong. They got to the same place, but all the facts were wrong. And in addition to that, if I'm to be intellectually honest enough, I would say that the position this first person was espousing would be in the ballpark of a position of somebody like a Bart Ehrman. If you're not familiar with Bart Ehrman, he's a famous author, famous New Testament scholar, not Orthodox in any sense of the word.
Well, I think he was a Christian and then moved to atheism, right?
Yes. I don't know. He's on the camp that would take that view of the Bible that, you know, this other person in the conversation was,
I think,
espousing.
He started finding what he thought were errors or inconsistencies.
Exactly. Yeah. So it would be more of the critical approach. Okay. And Bart Ehrman, although I strongly disagree with him, unquestionably knows his stuff. You know, he's probably in the top 1% of the top 1%. Very knowledgeable. If you, again, we're talking facts, not conclusion. People who know their facts about the New Testament. Bart Ehrman knows his facts. Period. Okay, so now we have an interesting dilemma from a fact-based perspective. We have two opinions that are allegedly based on facts by people who would be in the top 1%, if not much higher in Bart Ehrman's case, because I'm not trying to say my knowledge level is at his. But I could find other people who would take my general opinion or are much more knowledgeable than probably either of us. So you can play that game either way. And so we have fact-based opinion. And then we have opinions based on totally wrong facts. You know, they're just wrong. They are objectively untrue. And they wind up at the same place. So I started thinking about this. And this is rather a horrifying discovery when you start to pull on this thread, you know, and this is where the specifics of the Bible and all of that don't matter for the rest of this conversation. That's just the example, because it's kind of like this, as I was analogizing this in my mind, like imagine that you are a world-class explorer, you know, and you're out to go reach a difficult hike, you know, you're going somewhere. This is old school explorer. So you've got your maps, you've got all your gear, you prepare wildly, you study everything that you need to study, and you set out, and through all this hard work and sweat, blood, and tears, you reach this location you've been trying to reach to, and it's earned. And then imagine somebody else stumbles out the door, drunk, naked, unprepared. They started at the same place you did, and they also wound up at the same place you did. And they did none of the work and none of the prep. And that's kind of the situation that we have. And so this is a little bit horrified when you start to think of it from that perspective, because it really calls into question, or begins to call into question, the value of all of that preparation. Even more, we can say that if I am the studious, prepared explorer in this analogy, there's plenty of other areas where I have strong opinions, where I'm likely the naked drunk wandering through the wilderness, right? So what do you do with this? And so I found myself thinking about this, because there is sort of this paradoxical nature to this, where it sort of turns reality on our heads, because we like to assume the opinions that we hold are based on facts. Even if we accept what we've talked about with narrative and all of that, and even if we accept the fact that maybe we fill in, you know, rationality afterwards, we still believe that we have facts to back it up. But, and this is the significance of being somebody in that top 1%, because that allows me to have enough knowledge to say, no, you don't. In other words, any area, we can't prove this, but I'll make this jump. Any area where you're not in that top 1% or reasonably close to it, and you have what you consider to be a fact-based opinion, your facts are probably wrong. That would be the implication of this
experiment.
So
if you're not one of the smartest people in the world on a subject, you are probably wrong about what you think about it.
No, because your conclusion could be right, because your conclusion probably agrees with the smart people in the world.
Okay.
But all the facts that you would use to support it are probably wrong. So this is where you can run that experiment. If you have something that your knowledge of is in the top 1%, go look at arguments of people who aren't in the top 1% who agree with you and people who don't agree with you, and objectively measure, as much as you can objectively measure, how accurate their facts are. I'm willing to bet that you find that they're wrong all the way across the board with almost a 100% hit rate. And this is where you have to be, you know, there's a subjective portion here where I can't guarantee this experiment's going to work for everybody, because you have to be able to accurately judge if you're in that top 1% and then accurately judge, you know, the facts without bias of I agree with this person, so I'm going to go easy on them. So this really calls a lot into question. Because the implication of this is that we're all going around on all sorts of things every single day, and we're making decisions, opinions, beliefs, and not just theoretical ones, but ones that can actually impact ourselves and others with no factual basis whatsoever. Okay? Scary part number two is that it works. Right?
Like, we are wrong in our facts, but we still get to the right place.
We still get to the right place, or we at least get to places that could be considered right. Okay? So, you, as you go about your life making decisions and forming beliefs and all of the things that you do that are part of what make you human, and you assume that you're doing that all of those things are based on facts, they're not, but your life still works. It's a bit like this. To throw another analogy out there, you have lights on in here, so clearly electricity is working. But then let's say that you demolish the walls and you can't find any wires, but the lights are still on. Like, whoa, that's kind of freaky. I mean, I'm glad they are. Like, I'm glad there's still power, but something's off here. Like, the world works fundamentally different than I thought it did, is the implication of that. Okay, so what do you do with that? I started to think about all of this. It's like, the one thing I think you can't say, though it's very tempting to, is that facts don't matter. Why? Because eventually there are these hard walls of reality. When we do talk about Lawrence of Arabia in an episode where we're going to come back to that concept, there are the hard walls of reality. There is such a thing as a fact. There is such a thing as reality. So unless we want to go full subjectivist, full postmodern, I don't think we can head down that road. And indeed, we can observe from probably with faulty facts that people who do head down that road, don't wind up philosophically or otherwise in a good place. Postmodernism has shown itself to be a destructive force, and I could prove that to you with all sorts of non-facts, but the conclusion's right, even though my facts would be garbage, right? So what do you do then? So I have a couple thoughts on that. And I started to play around with this concept of replacement facts. What is a replacement fact? Okay. So a replacement fact is this. We know in the case of the Bible arguments that you can reach this conclusion, mine, or Bart Ehrman's conclusion, or plenty of others, on a factual basis. Once that conclusion has been charted out, it's almost as though now there's that narrative out there. So somebody's found it. Somebody's discovered it, possibly due to facts. We'll say at least closer to facts than maybe they were. I think this falls apart, but let's roll with it for just a second. And now that narrative's out there. So now other people are able to inherit that narrative because we're narrative creatures. Right? We understand that we think more in terms of narrative than we think in terms of facts. And what do we do with that? Well, instead of, because we absorb the narrative much faster than we absorb the facts, I think part of what we do is we bring in our own replacement facts, which are not the facts that were used to arrive at said conclusion, but functionally work just as well. Okay? Now, what do I mean by functionally work just as well? Well, have we talked about the concept of directional accuracy? I don't know if we have or not.
I don't think we have, but maybe.
Okay, so directional accuracy looks a little bit like this. If when we talk about a fact, it's a very binary thing. Yes, no, right? Either that is true or it's not true. I call that pinpoint accuracy. Directional accuracy says I'm in the ballpark. Okay. So when I'm working through things at, you know, in my job and I'm leading people in technical discussions, eventually you kind of need to get to pinpoint accuracy when you're dealing with technical problems. Obviously, computers and all of that, they don't like ballpark accuracy. But when you're troubleshooting with people, when you're problem solving and things like brainstorming are all about getting yourself in the ballpark. They're actually not about hitting the right answer. It's about getting yourself in the general area where you can then find gold. So when we talk about replacement facts, or I talk about replacement facts, and I don't know of anybody else who's used that term, so this could be a Ben DeBono original, but probably somebody else has thought of the concept. What you're dealing with is not any fact will do, because we can say that there are facts that wouldn't do. So one fact that wouldn't do, if we want to take the conclusion and our narrative says that the canon of scripture is simply a political accident. You know, there's nothing divinely inspired about it, but it's a political accident. And we know that because the lizard people told us that. That's not a good enough replacement fact. It's not in the ballpark of what the Bart Ehrmans of the world would actually lay out as their facts to support their opinions. You know, and you could do something similar on the other side. So a replacement fact needs to be in the ballpark. And I think this is interesting, and part of why I reject the facts don't matter, because what you see when you start to peel this apart is that all of their facts are wrong, but not entirely.
So they have enough true things in their wrongness.
They're in the ballpark.
To get them directionally accurate.
Yes, they are close, to the real thing, but they're not the real thing, but they're close enough to work. They're close enough to hold up the narrative.
I don't really know what we do. Like, I know you have more in your outline, but is at the end of this episode, are you going to tell us how to know if we have real facts?
Put a pin in that.
Okay.
Okay. Because, yeah, so then the other stuff I have, because I think a lot of this episode is thinking out loud. Some of the questions I found myself asking is, does this mean our narratives don't correspond to reality, or that facts inadequately capture reality? Okay, so coming back
probably to the second one, what do you think?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it is, actually. In other words, again, I'm not talking about, like, how to build an internal combustion engine. You probably need a lot more pinpoint accuracy for that, right? So I'm not talking about that. We'll come back to that in a second. But, like, reason I said, as I laid out, that to establish a narrative, you establish it first based on facts, and then the replacement facts can come in. I think that's probably too simplistic, because that's probably not what even happens in those cases. Well, probably what happens is people naturally have whatever narrative for whatever reasons, and then over time, a narrative gets propped up by replacement facts. Smart people come along and find real facts to support it and quote-unquote refine it, in which case the narrative is then advanced further. So I would guess that facts are never leading the way.
So somebody stumbles upon something that's true, but they don't have the right facts to back it up.
Yeah.
And then other people are like, yeah, I think that's right. And then they find facts that are actually more true. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, yeah. That's exactly what I'm saying.
You think that happens all the time, or you think that just happens in general?
I think that is the natural way of human logic.
Of learning truth.
Yeah, and truth might be too bold of a claim, because we're at least for this, because we're talking about opinion.
Okay.
We're talking about opinion that would be based on a collection of facts.
Okay.
So I don't want to equate that with truth. It could be, but it also could not be. What I would say is that people establish narratives that based on non-factual reasons that have viable opinions. And then people come along and support them with actual facts. Okay. So it's actually the other way around. The replacement facts are the facts,
yeah.
Which is kind of funny.
Man.
So, you know, and that's where, okay, facts inadequately capture reality. What does that mean? We think, because we're all wired with modernism, that facts are the main interface between ourselves and reality. And again, if you're building an internal combustion engine, that's probably more true than not. So modernism, hats off to you for discovering science. But science isn't the real thing, or at least not the whole thing, right? Science is very good at what it does, but it doesn't do everything. And the scary part here is that the way you as a human primarily interface with reality has nothing to do with facts. It has to do with narrative. And the facts support that, not the other way around, which is what we like to think.
We kind of talked about this in the last episode. So in some ways, people are picking what they want the end of the story to be.
Yeah.
And then they're filling in the plot to get to that end.
Yes.
Yes, and just to replace plot with facts.
Very much so.
Okay.
Yeah. And that leads to a second question, which is, how hard are the hard walls of reality? Okay. This table is going to stay hard no matter how many times I knock on it. Unless we discover more advanced physics that says maybe that's not true. You know, to put this another way, how much can you will reality into existence? And what I mean by that is, I try not to do the Lawrence of Arabia episode here.
Yeah, that's next.
But holy
crap. I think
crap.
It might be in the extra feed, though, actually.
Yeah, it could be. So just a taste to get people over into the extra feed. Like, in Lawrence of Arabia, you see him as a character almost will reality into existence at different points of that movie. Of course, it gets more complicated as time goes on, but you just see him willing reality into existence. So I like to put the frame on this of the simulation, not to say that there is a simulation, but, you know, it's kind of like, if we were in a simulation, would you be able to will it into existence? And you say, well, that's ridiculous. but it doesn't feel like it. And if it doesn't feel like it, what's the difference? Put it another way. We've talked about the example of people who think they are more lucky. People who think they are lucky have more luck. I've used the example of the test where they're supposed to flip through a newspaper. How many ads are in the newspaper? And people who think they are lucky are more likely to see that on the second page, it gives away the answer. Stop flipping through the paper. There's 36 ads. And they see that, not because it's there for them and not there for other people, but because they're on the lookout for luck. And so their belief in being lucky shapes reality for them.
I was thinking, after you did that episode last week, I was thinking about sometimes in life, Des and I might encounter some sort of upcoming challenge. How are we going to manage through this? Maybe it's financial, as an example. And I said recently, things always just work out. So I'm sure this will also just work out. And that's my mindset. And it does just work out. Is that the same thing?
I think it is. Now, the tricky part is that, like, because we want to be, we're so wired to be binary thinkers that it's really easy to go to the other extreme and say that nothing matters. It's more like reality is kind of like a rubber band. There are points beyond which we can't stretch it. And probably different people among us are better able to stretch it more than others. But there's a point beyond which it doesn't stretch. That's what I call the hard walls of reality. There is such a thing as being real. But I do think that there is a certain type of elasticity to reality. Let me give you a couple of examples. You moved to this house from an apartment. And I bet on day one, it felt like you had all sorts of space. Does it feel that way anymore?
No, it does not.
Okay. Have you ever had an experience at work where you schedule a half-hour meeting and get through everything? And then you schedule an hour meeting for the same amount of material and also just barely get through everything?
I'm sure that's happened.
Yeah. Time becomes elastic. Okay. And money, I think, does the same thing, though please don't take financial advice out of anything that's about to come out of my mouth. Okay. Don't treat your money like it's elastic, but it kind of feels that way in the moment, right? Like, things kind of tend to work out up to a certain point. Because in all of these, you can see where the rubber band snaps. In other words, let's say that through horrible hardship, you had to move back to an apartment. It would feel horribly cramped right away. And then eventually it wouldn't. But there is such a thing. There is a point past which where it literally would be too cramped. And you know this. You know this because if you go like to Europe or other countries, it'd be very common for a family your size to be living in a flat, you know, an apartment, much smaller than your house here. Okay, so people do it. So there's an elasticity there. Similarly, if we were to give you a 200,000 square foot house, it would be too big. You know, so there's a point where the rubber band snaps. To use the meeting example, if you schedule 5 minutes for a topic, you may very well run out of time. If you schedule 3 hours for the same topic, you're going to have way too much. But there's a lot of topics, and I sit through so many meetings, where if they're a half hour or an hour, doesn't make a difference. Why? People find a reason to fill or contract the time. It's elastic. I think reality kind of works that way. And I don't quite know how to explain it. Am I saying that you can literally will things into being? Not necessarily, but I'm saying it feels like it. At the minimum, it feels like it. And I'm not talking about the power of prayer. That's a different topic, because like, we're all on board with God, or at least you and I are here. I can't speak for all of our listeners, but we're all on board with the concept of prayer changing things. I'm talking about something different, but related. Because it almost goes to what Tolkien talked about of the concept that we're sub-creators with God, like where God wants us to be co-creators with him. Okay, take that really literally. Like, what I feel like people take that in the dumbest, most banal way possible when they hear, you know, God wants us to grow up to be like him. So, you know, make sure you get to church. I'm very in favor. I don't mean to minimize going to church, like, because I think people do have a problem with that. And I'm going way too long on this episode. But, like, you know, people take it in this banal way, but what if it's very literal? Like, what if God has given us to different degrees the ability to influence our will, to exert our will on reality in a way that actually changes things, or at least feels like it? Because if we can't say what it is, but we can observe it happening, it sure feels like it. You know, study affirmations. And I'm not necessarily going to endorse the concept of affirmations, but you can study this. You can read things. It's wild. It's really wild what people have accomplished with affirmations.
All because of your mindset.
Maybe. Like, maybe that's all it is. Maybe on some level, though, that we can't understand and don't have facts for, we are actually influencing reality. Maybe at some point it becomes measurable. But then this is that goes to the last question I have written down, which is, what's the difference between delusion and narrative? Like, that's kind of, because like, what gets scarier is the lines start to blur really, really, really fast. Okay, I know that this is a delusion. So, but what's the difference between that and saying I have a narrative and I'm going to exert it on reality? Like, I think you can see people, especially very charismatic people. You know, we all hate politicians, but watch a really skilled politician. And by the way, both Barack Obama and Donald Trump were tremendously skilled politicians, even though you probably think one of them was an idiot. It doesn't matter which one, but they're both had levels of genius in this area of being able to, and I pick them, you could pick others, but I pick them out because they're the most recent two that everybody's convinced is just, everybody's convinced at least one of them is an idiot. And it doesn't mean you have to like either or both of them. But you need to, at least if you're going to have your eyes open to reality, see the real, real talent there. And part of that talent at least looks like the ability to change reality, to will things into existence. And both of them sure look like they did to different degrees. But again, it's elastic. Doesn't mean they can just do, this isn't the Matrix. They can't do whatever they want.
You know, as you're saying that, I'm wondering, if you can get enough people on board with your narrative, is that what reshapes reality?
It very well could be.
We're thinking of charismatic leaders that can rally huge amount of support. And then we talked about the end of the story. They can make their end of the story happen.
Yeah.
With enough support, with enough belief.
Right. It sure feels like it. You know, you can feel people like, and I can even feel it myself because I'm a very strange person socially in the sense that there are times I'm incredibly socially awkward and have, you know, don't do small talk well and can just feel like I have no pull. But then I have other times, especially in a leadership context, where you can just feel it. Like, you can just feel the influence that you have on people. And that's incredibly powerful. And it's like, this is more than just, I'm not saying that it's magic, like that, not at all. But I don't think we have adequate facts to explain what's happening. There's a phenomenon that's happening. I do actually believe this, that goes beyond just, oh, people like you, and so they'll listen to you and you're convincing. Like, there's actually something more than that that's happening. But I don't know what it is. Anyway, your facts don't matter. But you should probably still have some.
You said put a pin in. Can we find a way to know if we have the right facts?
Yeah, that's maybe the conclusion. It probably doesn't matter. I guess I was thinking about this afternoon. And I was in a meeting late in the day, and it was on a minute or two early, and one of the other, you know, a couple project managers were on the meeting and something like that.
You're saying virtual meeting?
Yeah. So they're on the meeting, and, you know, I see the spreadsheet that's up, and we're kind of talking for a minute. One of them said, oh, my brain's really tired and everything. And I said, oh, that's okay. It's best if you just do this by instinct anyway. I said, it doesn't matter what we write down here because it's all going to change anyway. That's actually true. Like, everything that was written down on that spreadsheet in terms of, like, hard facts of dates, responsibilities, is all going to change. Yet, there's still something, like, the wrong answer then would be, we wasted our time. No, because we're, like, establishing something, call it a narrative, call it whatever, and the facts are there because we need them. We actually need them to be there, even though we know all those dates and everything are wrong. but we still need them to be there.
Does that have to do with what you're saying about being directionally accurate?
Yeah.
You needed that to get you in some sort
of you need to get
semi-accurate direction.
100%.
Wow.
Like, you meet people, and I see this a lot with work, who get really stuck on accurate planning.
Mm-hmm.
I care about planning up to a point, and then I don't care at all. Yeah. like, get me in the ballpark. Because it's Anyway, how do you know if you have the right facts? Assume you don't, but also assume it probably doesn't matter. Unless you're doing a science thing.
Or if, like, someone's life is on the line.
Like, if you're a pilot, I care about your facts a lot more.
Well, listeners, that's all from here. I'm Ben Anderson.
I'm Ben DiBono.
We're the Sapphire Christian signing off. Ben, nice episode. Wow.
Thank you.
When you led with, it's about facts, I was like, all right. I mean, I trust you. But even,
I told you.
Even better than I imagined.
I told you.
It was good. All right, listeners, thank you and goodbye.
There, goodbye. I went longer than I thought. I'm sorry.
I like it. I want to ask you something post-music, just in case I don't want to keep it.
Okay.
So feel free to answer as honest as you want.
All right.
If you had to guess what I would be in the 1% of most knowledgeable about, what do you think it would be? And you could be say whatever you think is true.
Well, yeah, knowledge is interesting, but for sure, skill-wise, like, you know, you've, especially throughout your career, established certain skills around fundraising, networking, all of that, things that come very naturally to you that don't come naturally to most people. I think you're easily in the top 1% on that. You're probably in the top 1% in a lot of your theological knowledge, or at least close to it, just by the degree that you've earned. I mean, like, again, this is what's very free. It should be humbling, but also freeing it, because just because you're in the 1%, like, it gets exponentially harder the more you grow up. Like, the gap between the top 1% and the top half of a percent is astronomical. But you can get there fairly easily. You know, you could probably come up with a number of, sort of, for sure, like, lost facts are the top 1%. Easy, you know, but, like, anything that you have studied to a normal degree, you're probably everybody who listened to our Moby Dick episodes are now in the top 1% of people. Wow. When it comes to Moby Dick knowledge.
That's kind
of
cool.
Yeah.
So if you subscribe to our extra feed, or no, I was going to say Patreon feed, but over on the Uncensored feed, now are in the top 1% of everybody who's knowledgeable about Moby Dick.
Well, think about it. Get 99 other random people. How many of them have read Moby Dick? 5. You know, out of those 5, how many can actually say something intelligent about it? Maybe one other. Maybe. And so then you probably have a decent chance of besting them. I'd say you're for sure in the top 5% of people. Easy.
Wow.
You know, to be in the top 5% of people, that means there's 800 million people better than you.
Yeah.
Okay, so be humbled.
Yeah.
like it doesn't take a lot to get there, but it's also really cool, because if you say that to be successful in life, you need to arrive at the top 5% of a certain number of things, you can actually aim at that and hit it pretty easily. It doesn't take a lot. If you said, I want to hone my skill in this area where I'm in the top 5% of all the people in the world, you can do that really easily.
Yeah, let's end it here by saying, let's come back to talent stacking. I think that sounds I've read about it in what's the book called?
How to Fail at Almost Everything.
Yeah, I think it's in there. Big. But it would be good to have a conversation.
Yeah, no, that'll change your life.
All right, listeners, thank you. And that's all, folks.
Goodbye.